he returned.
At the end of January, he finally went to see Andy, who listened to him and then examined him carefully.
"There's nothing wrong with you as such," he said when he was finished. "You're just getting older."
"Oh," he said, and they were both quiet, for what was there for them to say? "Well," he said at last, "maybe I'll get so weak that I'll be able to convince Willem I don't have the energy to go to Lohmann any longer." Because one night that fall, he had, stupidly, drunkenly, romantically even, promised Willem he'd see Dr. Lohmann for another 9 months. Andy had sighed, but had smiled too. "You're such a brat," he said. Now, though, he thinks back on this period fondly. For in every other way that mattered, that winter was a glorious time. In December, Willem had been nominated for a major award for his work in The Poisoned Apple. In January, he won it. Then he was nominated again for an even bigger and more prestigious award, and again he won. He had been in London on business the night Willem won, but had set his alarm for 2 a.m. so he could wake and watch the ceremony online. When Willem's name was called, he shouted out loud, watched Willem, beaming, kiss Julia, whom he had brought as his date, and bound up the stairs to the stage, listened as he thanked the filmmakers, the studio, Emile, Kit, Alan Turing himself, Roman and Cressy and Richard and Malcolm and J.B. and "my in-laws, Julia Altman and Harold Stein, for always making me feel like I was their son as well. And finally and most important, Jude St. Francis, my best friend and the love of my life, for everything." He'd had to stop himself from crying then, and when he got through to Willem half an hour later, he had to stop himself again.
"I'm so proud of you, Willem," he said. "I knew you would win. I knew it."
"You always think that," Willem laughed, and he laughed too, because Willem was right. He always did. He always thought Willem deserved to win awards for whatever he was nominated for. On the occasions he didn't, he was genuinely perplexed. Politics and preferences aside, how could the judges, the voters, deny what was so obviously a superior performance, a superior actor, a superior person? In his meetings the next morning, in which he had to stop himself from not crying but smiling, dopily and incessantly, his colleagues congratulated him and asked him again why he hadn't gone to the ceremony, and he had shaken his head.
"Those things aren't for me," he said, and they weren't.
Of all the award shows, all the premieres, all the parties that Willem went to for work, he had attended only two or three. This past year, when Willem was being interviewed by a serious literary magazine for a long profile, he vanished whenever he knew the writer would be present. He knew Willem wasn't offended by this, that he attributed his scarcity to his sense of privacy. And while this was true, it wasn't the only reason. Once, shortly after they had become a couple, there had been a picture of them that had run with a Time story about Willem and the first installment he had completed in a spy movie trilogy. The photo had been taken at the opening of JB's fifth, long-delayed show, Frog and Toad, which had been exclusively images of the two of them, but very blurred and more abstract than JB's previous work. They hadn't quite known what to think of the series' title, although JB had claimed it was affectionate.
"Arnold Lobel?"
he had screeched at them when they asked him about it.
"Hello?"
But neither he nor Willem had read Lobel's books as children, and they'd had to go out and buy them to make sense of the reference. Curiously, it had been this show, even more than the initial New York Magazine story about Willem's new life, that had made their relationship real for their colleagues and peers, despite the fact that most of the paintings had been made from photographs taken before they had become a couple. It was also this show that would mark, as J.B. later said, his ascendancy. They knew that despite his sales, his reviews, his fellowships and accolades, he was tormented that Richard had had a mid-career museum retrospective
as had Asian Henry Young, and he hadn't. But after Frog and Toad, something shifted for J.B., the way that the Sycamore Court had shifted things for Willem, the way that the Doha Museum had shifted things for Malcolm, even the way, if he was to be boastful, that the Malgrave and basket suit had shifted things for him. It was only when he stepped outside his firmament of friends that he realized that that shift that they had all hoped for and received, was rarer and more precious than they even knew. Of all of them, only J.B. had been certain that he deserved that shift, that it was absolutely going to happen for him. He and Malcolm and Willem had had no such certainty, and so when it was given to them, they were befuddled. But although J.B. had had to wait the longest for his life to change, he was calm when it finally did. Something in him seemed to become defanged. He became, for the first time since they had known him, mellowed, and the constant prickly humor that fizzed off of him like static was demagnetized and quieted. He was glad for J.B. He was glad he now had the kind of recognition he wanted, the kind of recognition he thought J.B. should have received after seconds, minutes, hours, days. "The question is which one of us is the frog and which is the toad," Willem had said after they'd first seen the show in J.B.'s studio and read the kind-hearted books to each other late that night, laughing helplessly as they did. He'd smiled. They had been lying in bed. "Obviously I'm the toad," he said. "No," Willem said. "I think you're the frog. Your eyes are the same color as his skin." Willem sounded so serious that he grinned. "That's your evidence?" he asked. "And so what do you have in common with the toad?" "I think I actually have a jacket like the one he has," Willem said, and they began laughing again. But really, he knew. He was the toad, and seeing the picture in the Times of the two of them together had reminded him of this. He wasn't so bothered by this for his own sake. He was trying to care less about his own anxieties, but for Willem's, because he was aware of how mismatched, how distorted a couple they made, and he was embarrassed for him, and worried that his mere presence might be somehow harmful to Willem. And so he tried to stay away from him in public. He had always thought that Willem was capable of making him better, but over the years, he feared, if Willem could make him better, didn't that also mean that he could make Willem sick? And in the same way, if Willem could make him into someone less difficult to regard, couldn't he also make Willem into something ugly? He knew this wasn't logical, but he thought it anyway. And sometimes, as they were getting ready to go out, he glimpsed himself in the bathroom mirror, his stupid, pleased expression, as absurd and grotesque as a monkey dressed in expensive clothes, and would want to punch the glass with his fist. But the other reason he was worried about being seen with Willem was because of the exposure it entailed. Ever since his first day of college, he had feared that someday someone from his past, a client, one of the boys from the home, would try to contact him, would try to extort something from him for their silence. "No one will, Jude," Anna had assured him. "I promise. To do so would be to admit how they know you." But he was always afraid, and over the years there had been a few ghosts who had announced themselves. The first arrived shortly after he'd started at Rosen Pritchard, just a postcard from someone who claimed he had known him from the home, someone with the unhelpfully indistinct name of Rob Wilson, someone he didn't remember, and for a week he had panicked, barely able to sleep, his mind scrolling through scenarios that seemed as terrifying as they were inevitable. What if this Rob Wilson contacted Harold, contacted his colleagues at the firm, and told them who he was, told them about the things he had done? But he made himself not react, not do what he wanted to do, write a near-hysterical cease-and-desist letter that would prove nothing but his own existence and the existence of his past, and he never heard from Rob Wilson again. But after a few pictures of him with Willem had appeared in the press, he received two more letters and an email, all sent to his work,
One of the letters and the email were again from men who claimed they had been at the home with him, but once again, he hadn't recognized their names, and he never responded, and they never contacted him again. But the second letter had contained a copy of a photograph, black and white, of an undressed boy on a bed, and of such low quality that he couldn't tell if it was him or not. And with this letter, he had done what he had been told to do all those years ago, when he was a child in a hospital bed in Philadelphia. Should any of the clients figure out who he was and try to establish communication with him, he had put the letter in an envelope and had sent it to the FBI. They always knew where he was, that office, and every 4 or 5 years, an agent would appear at his workplace to show him pictures, to ask him if he remembered one man or another. Men who were decades later still being uncovered as Dr. Taylor's, Brother Luke's, friends, and fellow criminals. He rarely had advance warning before these visits, and over the years, he had learned what he needed to do in the days afterward in order to neutralize them. How he needed to surround himself with people, with events, with noise and clamor, with evidence of the life he now inhabited. In this period, the one in which he had received and disposed of the letter, he had felt vividly ashamed and intensely alone. This had been before he had told Willem about his childhood, and he had never given Andy enough context so that he would appreciate the terror that he was experiencing. And after, he had finally made himself hire an investigative agency, though not the one that Rosen Pritchard used, to uncover everything they could about him. The investigation had taken a month, but at its end, there was nothing conclusive, or at least nothing that could conclusively identify him as who he had been. It was only then that he allowed himself to relax, to believe finally that Anna had been right, to accept that, for the most part, his past had been erased so completely that it was as if it had never existed. The people who knew the most about it, who had witnessed and made it, Brother Luke, Dr. Traylor, even Anna, were dead, and the dead can speak to no one. "You're safe," he would remind himself. And although he was, it didn't mean he wasn't still cautious. It didn't mean that he would want to have his photograph in magazines and newspapers. He accepted that this was what his life with Willem would be, of course, but sometimes he wished it could be different, that he could be less circumspect about claiming Willem in public the way Willem had claimed him. In idle moments, he played the clip of Willem making his speech over and over, feeling that same giddiness he had when Harold had first named him as his son to another person. "This has really happened," he had thought at the time. "This isn't something I've made up." And now, the same delirium. He really was Willem's. He had said so himself. In March, at the end of award season, he and Richard had thrown Willem a party at Green Street. A large shipment of carved teak doorways and benches had just been moved out of the fifth floor, and Richard had strung the ceiling with ropes of lights and had lined every wall with glass jars containing candles. Richard's studio manager had brought two of their largest work tables upstairs, and he had called the caterers and a bartender. They had invited everyone they could think of, all of their friends in common, and all of Willem's as well. Harold and Julia, James and Carrie, Lawrence and Jillian, Lionel and Sinclair had come down from Boston. Kit had come out from L.A., Carolina from Yountville, Phaedra and Citizen from Paris, Willem's friends Cressy and Susanna from London, Miguel from Madrid. He made himself stand and walk through that party, at which people he knew only from Willem's stories, directors and actors and playwrights, approached him and said they'd been hearing about him for years and that it was so nice to finally meet him, that they'd been thinking that Willem had invented him. And although he had laughed, he had been sad as well, as if he should have ignored his fears and involved himself more in Willem's life. So many people there hadn't seen one another in so many years that it was a very busy party, the kind of party they had gone to when they were young, with people shouting at one another over the music that one of Richard's assistants, an amateur DJ, was playing. And a few hours into it, he was exhausted, and leaned against the northern wall of the space to watch everyone dance. In the middle of the scrum, he could see Willem dancing with Julia, and he smiled, watching them, before noticing that Harold was standing on the other side of the room, watching them as well, smiling as well. Harold saw him then, and raised his glass to him, and he raised his in return, and then watched as Harold worked his way toward him.
"Good party!"
Harold shouted into his ear.
"It's mostly Richard's doing,"
he shouted back, but as he was about to say something else, the music became louder, and he and Harold looked at each other and laughed and shrugged. For a while they simply stood, both of them smiling, watching the dancers heave and blur before them. He was tired. He was in pain. But it didn't matter. His tiredness felt like something sweet and warm. His pain was familiar and expected, and in those moments he was aware that he was capable of joyfulness, that life was honeyed. Then the music turned, grew dreamy and slow, and Harold yelled that he was going to reclaim Julia from Willem's clutches.
"Go,"
he told him. But before Harold left him, something made him reach out and put his arms around him, which was the first time he had voluntarily touched Harold since the incident with Caleb. He could see that Harold was stunned, and then delighted, and he felt guilt course through him, and moved away as quickly as he could, shooing Harold onto the dance floor as he did. There was a nest of cotton-stuffed burlap sacks in one of the corners, which Richard had put down for people to lounge against, and he was headed toward them when Willem appeared and grabbed his hand.
"Come dance with me," he said.
"Willem," he admonished him, smiling,
"you know I can't dance."
Willem looked at him then, appraisingly.
"Come with me,"
he said, and he followed Willem toward the east end of the loft and to the bathroom, where Willem pulled him inside and closed and locked the door behind them, placing his drink on the edge of the sink. They could still hear the music, a song that had been popular when they were in college, embarrassing and yet somehow moving in its unapologetic sentimentalism, in its syrup and sincerity. But in the bathroom it was dampened, as if it was being piped in from some far-off valley.
"Put your arms around me," Willem told him,
and he did. "Move your right foot back when I move my left one toward it," he said next, and he did. For a while they moved slowly and clumsily, looking at each other, silent.
"See,"
Willem said, quietly.
"You're dancing."
"I'm not good at it," he mumbled, embarrassed.
"You're perfect at it,"
Willem said. And although his feet were by this point so sore that he was beginning to perspire from the discipline it was taking not to scream, he kept moving, but so minimally that toward the end of the song they were only swaying, their feet not leaving the ground, Willem holding him so he wouldn't fall. When they emerged from the bathroom, there was a whooping from the groups of people nearest to them, and he blushed. The last, the final time he'd had sex with Willem had been almost 16 months ago, but Willem grinned and raised his arm as if he was a prize fighter who had just won a bout. And then it was April, and his 47th birthday, and then it was May, and he developed a wound on each calf, and Willem left for Istanbul to shoot the second installment in his spy trilogy. He had told Willem about the wounds. He was trying to tell him things as they happened, even things he didn't consider that important, and Willem had been upset. But he hadn't been concerned. How many of these wounds had he had over the years? Tens, dozens. The only thing that had changed was the amount of time he spent trying to resolve them. Now he went to Andy's office twice a week, every Tuesday lunchtime and Friday evening, once for debriding and once for a wound vacuum treatment, which Andy's nurse performed. Andy had always thought that his skin was too fragile for that treatment, in which a piece of sterile foam was fitted above the open sore and a nozzle moved above it that sucked the dead and dying tissues into the foam like a sponge. But in recent years, he had tolerated it well, and it had proven more successful than simply debriding alone. As he had grown older, the wounds, their frequency, their severity, their size, the level of discomfort that attended them, had grown steadily worse. Long gone, decades gone, were the days in which he was able to walk any great distance when he had them. The memory of strolling from Chinatown to the Upper East Side, albeit painfully, with one of these wounds was so strange and remote that it didn't even seem to belong to him, but to somebody else. When he was younger, it might take a few weeks for one to heal, but now it took months. Of all the things that were wrong with him, he was the most dispassionate about these sores, and yet he was never able to accustom himself to their very appearance. And although, of course, he wasn't scared of blood, the sight of pus, of rot, of his body's desperate attempt to heal itself by trying to kill part of itself still unsettled him even all these years later. By the time Willem came home for good, he wasn't better. There were now 4 wounds on his calves, the most he had ever had at one time, and although he was still trying to walk daily, it was sometimes difficult enough to simply stand, and he was vigilant about parsing his efforts, about determining when he was trying to walk because he thought he could, and when he was trying to walk to prove to himself that he was still capable of it. He could feel he had lost weight. He could feel he had gotten weaker. He could no longer even swim every morning. But he knew it for sure once he saw Willem's face. "Judy," Willem had said, quietly, and had knelt next to him on the sofa. "I wish you had told me." But in a funny way, there had been nothing to tell. This was who he was. And besides his legs, his feet, his back, he felt fine. He felt, though he hesitated to say this about himself, it seemed so bold a statement, mentally healthy. He was back to cutting himself only once a week. He heard himself whistling as he removed his pants at night, examining the area around the bandages to make sure none of them were leaking fluids. People got used to anything their bodies gave them. He was no exception. If your body was well, you expected it to perform for you, excellently, consistently. If your body was not, your expectations were different. Or this, at least, was what he was trying to accept. Shortly after he returned at the end of July, Willem gave him permission to terminate his mostly silent relationship with Dr. Lohmann, but only because he genuinely didn't have the time any longer. 4 hours of his week were now spent at doctor's offices, 2 with Andy, 2 with Lohmann, and he needed to reclaim 2 of those hours so he could go twice a week to the hospital, where he took off his pants and flipped his tie over his shoulder and was slid into a hyperbaric chamber, a glass coffin where he lay and did work and hoped that the concentrated oxygen that was being piped in all around him might help hasten his healing. He had felt guilty about his 18 months with Dr. Lohmann, in which he had revealed almost nothing, had spent most of his time childishly protecting his privacy, trying not to say anything, wasting both his and the doctor's time. But one of the few subjects they had discussed was his legs, not how they had been damaged, but the logistics of caring for them. And in his final session, Dr. Lohmann had asked what would happen if he didn't get better. "Amputation, I guess," he had said, trying to sound casual, although of course he wasn't casual, and there was nothing to guess. He knew that as surely as he would someday die, he would do so without his legs. He just had to hope it wouldn't be soon. "Please," he would sometimes beg his legs as he lay in the glass chamber. "Please, give me just a few more years. Give me another decade. Let me get through my 40s, my 50s intact. I'll take care of you, I promise." By late summer, his new bout of sicknesses, of treatments, had become so commonplace to him that he hadn't realized how affected Willem might be by them. Early that August, they were discussing what to do, something, nothing, for Willem's 49th birthday, and Willem had said he thought they should just do something low-key this year.
"Well, we'll do something big next year, for your 50th, he said. "If I'm still alive by then, that is."
and it wasn't until he heard Willem's silence that he had looked up from the stove and seen Willem's expression and had recognized his mistake.
"Willem, I'm sorry," he said, turning off the burner and making his slow, painful way over to him. "I'm sorry."
"You can't joke like that, Jude," Willem said, and he put his arms around him.
"I know," he said. "Forgive me. I was being stupid. Of course I'm going to be around next year. And for many years to come. And for many years to come."
Now it is September, and he is lying on the examining table in Andy's office, his wounds uncovered and still split open like pomegranates. And at nights, he is lying in bed next to Willem. He is often conscious of the unlikeliness of their relationship, and often guilty at his unwillingness to fulfill one of the core duties of couplehood. Every once in a while, he thinks he will try again, and then, just as he is trying to say the words to Willem, he stops, and another opportunity quietly slides away. But his guilt, as great as it is, cannot overwhelm his sense of relief, nor his sense of gratitude. That he should have been able to keep Willem despite his inabilities is a miracle, and he tries in every other way he can to always communicate to Willem how thankful he is. He wakes one night sweating so profusely that the sheets beneath him feel as if they've been dragged through a puddle, and in his haze he stands before he realizes he can't and falls. Willem wakes then and fetches him the thermometer, standing over him as he holds it under his tongue.
102, he says, examining it, and places his palm on his forehead.
But you're freezing. He looks at him, worried.
I'm going to call Andy.
Don't call Andy,
he says, and despite the fever, the chills, the sweating, he feels normal. He doesn't feel sick.
I just need some aspirin.
So Willem gets it, brings him a shirt, strips and remakes the bed, and they fall asleep again, Willem wrapped around him. The next night he wakes again with a fever, again with chills, again with sweating.
There's something going around the office, he tells Willem this time. Some 48-hour bug. I must have caught it.
Again he takes aspirin. Again it helps. Again he goes back to sleep. The day after that is a Friday, and he goes to Andy to have his wounds cleaned, but he doesn't mention the fever, which disappears by daylight. That night Willem is away, having dinner with Roman, and he goes to bed early, swallowing some aspirin before he does. He sleeps so deeply that he doesn't even hear Willem come in, but when he wakes the following morning, he is so sweaty that it looks as if he's been standing under the shower, and his limbs are numb and shaky. Beside him, Willem gently snores, and he sits, slowly, running his hands through his wet hair. He really is better that Saturday. He goes to work. Willem goes to meet a director for lunch. Before he leaves the offices for the evening, he texts Willem and tells him to ask Richard and India if they want to meet for sushi on the Upper East Side, at a little restaurant he and Andy sometimes go to after their appointments. He and Willem have two favorite sushi places near Green Street, but both of them have flights of descending stairs, and so they have been unable to go for months because the steps are too difficult for him. That night he eats well, and even as the fatigue punches him midway through the meal, he is conscious that he is enjoying himself, that he is grateful to be in this small, warm place, with its yellow-lit lanterns above him, and the wooden geta-like slab atop which are laid tongues of mackerel sashimi, Willem's favorite, before him. At one point he leans against Willem's side, from exhaustion and affection, but isn't even aware he's done so until he feels Willem move his arm and put it around him. Later he wakes in their bed, disoriented, and sees Harold sitting next to him, staring at him.
Harold, he says, what are you doing here?
But Harold doesn't speak, just lunges at him, and he realizes with a sickening lurch that Harold is trying to take his clothes off.
No,
he tells himself,
not Harold. This can't be.
This is one of his deepest, ugliest, most secret fears, and now it is coming true. But then his old instincts awaken. Harold is another client, and he will fight him away. He yells then, twisting himself, pinwheeling his arms and what he can of his legs, trying to intimidate, to fluster this silent, determined Harold before him, screaming for Brother Luke's help. And then, suddenly, Harold vanishes and is replaced by Willem, his face near his, saying something he can't understand. But behind Willem's head he sees Harold's again, his strange, grim expression, and he resumes his fight. Above him, he can hear words, can hear that Willem is talking to someone, can register even through his own fright, Willem's fright as well.
Willem, he calls out. He's trying to hurt me. Don't let him hurt me, Willem. Help me. Help me. Help me, please.
Then there is nothing, a stretch of blackened time. And when he wakes again, he is in the hospital.
Willem,
he announces to the room. And there, immediately, is Willem, sitting at the edge of his bed, taking his hand. There is a length of plastic tubing snaking out of the back of this hand, and out of the other as well.
Careful, Willem tells him. The IVs.
For a while they are silent, and Willem strokes his forehead.
He was trying to attack me,
he finally confesses to Willem, stumbling as he speaks.
I never thought Harold would do that to me. Not ever.
He can see Willem stiffen. No, Jude, he says. Harold wasn't there. You were delirious from the fever. It didn't happen. He is relieved and terrified to hear this. Relieved to hear that it wasn't true. Terrified because it seems so real, so actual. Terrified because what does it say about him? About how he thinks and what his fears are? That he should even imagine this about Harold. How cruel can his own mind be to try to convince him to turn against someone he has struggled so hard to trust, someone who has only ever shown him kindness? He can feel tears in his eyes, but he has to ask Willem.
He wouldn't do that to me, would he, Willem?
No, says Willem, and his voice is strained.
Never, Jude. Harold would never, ever do that to you. Not for anything.
When he wakes again, he realizes he doesn't know what day it is. And when Willem tells him it's Monday, he panics.
Work, he says. I have to go.
No fucking way, Willem says, sharply. I called them, Jude. You're not going anywhere. Not until Andy figures out what's going on. Harold and Julia arrive later, and he makes himself return Harold's embrace, although he cannot look at him. Over Harold's shoulder he sees Willem, who nods at him reassuringly. They are all together when Andy comes in. Osteomyelitis, he says to him quietly. A bone infection. He explains what will happen. He will have to stay in the hospital for at least a week.
A week,
he exclaims. And the four of them start shouting at him before he has a chance to protest further, or possibly two, until they get the fever under control. The antibiotics will be dispensed through a central line, but the remaining 10 to 11 weeks of treatment will be given to him on an outpatient basis. Every day a nurse will come administer the IV drip. The treatment will take an hour, and he is not to miss a single one of these. When he tries, again, to protest, Andy stops him. Jude, he says, this is serious. I mean it. I don't fucking care about Rose and Pritchard. You want to keep your legs? You do this and you follow my instructions. Do you understand me? Around him, the others are silent.
Yes,
he says, at last. A nurse comes to prep him so Andy can administer the central venous catheter, which will be inserted into the subclavian vein, directly beneath his right collarbone. This is a tricky vein to access because it's so deep, the nurse says, pulling down the neck of his gown and cleaning a square of his skin. But you're lucky to have Dr. Contractor. He's very good with needles. He never misses. He isn't worried, but he knows Willem is, and he holds Willem's hand as Andy first pierces his skin with a cold metal needle and then threads the coil of guide wire into him.
Don't look, he tells Willem. It's okay.
And so Willem stares instead at his face, which he tries to keep still and composed until Andy is finished and is taping the catheter's length of slender plastic tubing to his chest. He sleeps. He had thought he might be able to work from the hospital, but he is more exhausted than he thought he would be, cloudier. And after talking to the chairs of the various committees and some of his colleagues, he doesn't have the strength to do anything else. Harold and Julia leave. They have classes and office hours, but except for Richard and a few people from work, they don't tell anyone he's hospitalized. He won't be there for long, and Willem has decided he needs sleep more than he needs visitors. He is still febrile, but less so, and there have been no further episodes of delirium. And strangely, for all that is happening, he feels, if not optimistic, then at least calm. Everyone around him is so sober, so thin-lipped, that he feels determined to defy them somehow, to defy the severity of the situation they keep telling him he's in. He can't remember when he and Willem started referring to the hospital as the Hotel Contractor, in honor of Andy, but it seems they always have. Watch out, Willem would say to him, even back at Lispenard Street, when he was hacking at a piece of steak some enraptured sous chef at Ortolan had sneaked Willem at the end of his shift. That cleaver's really sharp, and if you chop off a thumb, we'll have to go to the Hotel Contractor. Or once, when he was hospitalized for a skin infection, he had sent Willem, away somewhere shooting, a text reading, "At Hotel Contractor. Not a big deal, but didn't want you to hear through M or JB." Now, though, when he tries to make Hotel Contractor jokes, complaining about the hotel's increasingly poor food and beverage services, about its poor quality of linens, Willem doesn't respond. "This isn't funny, Jude," he snaps on Friday evening as they wait for Harold and Julia to arrive with dinner. "I wish you'd fucking stop kidding around." He is quiet then, and they look at each other.
"I was so scared,"
Willem says, in a low voice.
"You were so sick, and I didn't know what was going to happen, and I was so scared."
"Willem," he says gently, "I know. I'm so grateful for you."
He hurries on before Willem can tell him he doesn't need to be grateful. He needs him to take the situation seriously.
"I'm going to listen to Andy, I promise. I promise you I'm taking this seriously. And I promise you I'm not in any discomfort. I feel fine. It's going to be fine."
After 10 days, Andy is satisfied that the fever has been eliminated, and he is discharged and sent home for 2 days to rest. He is back at the office on Friday. He had always resisted having a driver. He liked to drive himself. He liked the independence, the solitude. But now Willem's assistant has hired a driver for him. A small, serious man named Mr. Ahmed, and on his way to and from the office, he sleeps. Mr. Ahmed also picks up his nurse, a woman named Patricia, who rarely speaks but is very gentle, and every day at 1 p.m. she meets him at Rosen Pritchard. His office there is all glass and looks out onto the floor, and he lowers the shades for privacy and takes off his jacket and tie and shirt, and lies down on the sofa in his undershirt and covers himself with a blanket, and Patricia cleans the catheter and checks the skin around it to make sure there are no signs of infection, no swelling, no redness, and then inserts the IV and waits as the medicine drips into the catheter and slides into his veins. As they wait, he works, and she reads a nursing journal or knits. Soon this too becomes normal. Every Friday he sees Andy, who debrides his wounds and then examines him, sending him to the hospital after their session for x-rays so he can track the infection and make sure it isn't spreading. They cannot go away on the weekends because he needs to have his treatment, but in early October, after 4 weeks of antibiotics, Andy announces that he's been talking to Willem, and if he doesn't mind, he and Jane are going to come up to stay with them in Garrison for the weekend, and he'll administer the drip himself. It is wonderful and rare being out of the city, being back at their house, and the four of them enjoy one another's company. He even feels well enough to give Andy an abbreviated tour of the property, which Andy has visited only in springtime or summer, but which is different in autumn. Raw, sad, lovely. The barn's roof plastered with fallen yellow ginkgo leaves that make it look as if it's been laid with sheets of gold leaf. Over dinner that Saturday night, Andy asks him, "You do realize we've now known each other for 30 years, right?"
"I do," he smiles.
He has, in fact, bought Andy something, a safari vacation for him and his family, to go on whenever he wants, for their anniversary, although he hasn't told him about it yet.
30 years of being disobeyed," Andy moans, and the rest of them laugh.
30 years of dispensing priceless medical advice gleaned from years of experience and training at top institutions, only to have it ignored by a corporate litigator who's decided his understanding of human biology is superior to my own.
After they've stopped laughing, Jane says, "But you know, Andy, if it weren't for Jude, I never would have married you."
To him, she says, "In medical school, I always thought Andy was sort of a self-absorbed douchebag, Jude. He was so arrogant, so borderline callow."
"What?"
Andy says, feigning injury. "That I assumed he was going to be one of those typical surgeons, you know, not always right, but always certain. But then I heard him talk about you, how much he loved and respected you, and I thought there might be something more to him. And I was right."
"You were," he tells her, after they all laugh again.
"You were right." And they all look at Andy, who gets embarrassed and pours himself another glass of wine. The week after that, Willem begins rehearsals for his new film. A month ago, when he got sick, he had backed out of the project, and then it had been delayed to wait for him, and now things are stable enough that he has signed on again. He doesn't understand why Willem had backed out in the first place. The film is a remake of Desperate Characters, and most of the filming will be done just across the river in Brooklyn Heights. But he is relieved to have Willem at work again, and not hovering over him, looking worried and asking him if he's sure he has the energy to do any of the very basic things, going to the grocery store, making a meal, staying late at work, that he wants to do. In early November, he goes back to the hospital with another fever, but only stays for 2 nights before he's released again. Patrizia draws his blood every week, but Andy has told him that he'll have to be patient. Bone infections take a long time to eradicate, and he probably won't have a sense of whether he's been healed for good or not until the end of the 12-week cycle. But otherwise, everything trudges on. He goes to work. He goes to have his treatments in the hyperbaric chamber. He goes to have his wounds vacuum treated. He goes to have them debrided. One of the side effects from the antibiotics is diarrhea. Another is nausea. He is losing weight at a rate even he can tell is problematic. He has 8 of his shirts and 2 of his suits retailored. Andy prescribes him high-calorie drinks meant for malnourished children, and he swallows them 5 times a day, gulping water afterward to erase their chalky, tongue-coating flavor. Except for the hours he keeps at the office, he is conscious of being more obedient than he ever has been, of heeding every one of Andy's warnings, of following his every piece of advice. He is still trying not to think of how this episode might end, trying not to worry himself, but in dark, quiet moments, he replays what Andy said to him on one of his recent checkups. "Heart? Perfect. Lungs? Perfect. Vision, hearing, cholesterol, prostate, blood sugar, blood pressure, lipids, kidney function, liver function, thyroid function, all perfect.
Your body's equipped to work as hard as it can for you, Jude. Make sure you let it. He knows that isn't the complete measure of who he is. Circulation, for example, not perfect. Reflexes, not perfect. Anything south of his groin, compromised. But he tries to take comfort in Andy's reassurances, to remind himself that things could be worse, that he is essentially still a healthy person, still a lucky person. Late November. Willem finishes Desperate Characters. They have Thanksgiving at Harold and Julia's uptown, and although they have been coming into the city every other weekend to see him, he can sense them both trying very hard not to say anything about his appearance, not to bother him about how little he's eating at dinner. Thanksgiving week also marks his final week of antibiotic treatments, and he submits to another round of blood work and x-rays before Andy tells him he can stop. He says goodbye to Patrizia for what he hopes is the last time. He gives her a gift to thank her for her care. Although his wounds have shrunk, they haven't shrunk as much as Andy had hoped, and on his recommendation they stay in Garrison for Christmas. They promise Andy it will be a quiet week. Everyone else will be out of town anyway, so it will be only the two of them and Harold and Julia. Your two goals are sleeping and eating, says Andy, who is going to visit Beckett in San Francisco for the holidays. I want to see you 5 pounds heavier by the first Friday in January.
5 pounds is a lot, he says.
5, Andy repeats. And then, ideally, 15 more after that. On Christmas itself, a year to the day, he and Willem had walked along the spine of a low, wavy mountainside in Punaka, one that took them behind the King's Hunting Lodge, a simple wooden structure that looked like it might be full of Chaucerian pilgrims, not the royal family. He tells Harold he wants to take a walk. Julia and Willem have gone horseback riding at an acquaintance's nearby ranch, and he is feeling stronger than he has in a long time. I don't know, Jude, says Harold, warily.
Come on, Harold, he says. Just to the first bench.
Malcolm has placed 3 benches along the path he has hacked through the forest to the house's rear. One is located about a third of the way around the lake, the second at the halfway point, and the third at the two-thirds point.
We'll go slowly, and I'll take my cane.
It has been years since he has had to use a cane, not since he was a teenager. But now he needs it for any distance longer than 50 yards or so. Finally, Harold agrees, and he grabs his scarf and coat before Harold can change his mind. Once they are outdoors, his euphoria increases. He loves this house. He loves how it looks. He loves its quiet. And most of all, he loves that it is his and Willem's, as far from Lispenard Street as imaginable. But as much theirs as that place was, something they made together and share. The house, which faces a second, different forest, is a series of glass cubes, and preceding it is a long driveway that switchbacks through the woods, so at certain angles you can see only swatches of it, and at other angles it disappears completely. At night, when it is lit, it glows like a lantern, which was what Malcolm had named it in his monograph, Lantern House. The back of the house looks out onto a wide lawn, and beyond it, a lake. At the bottom of the lawn is a pool, which is lined with slabs of slate so that the water is always cold and clear, even on the hottest days, and in the barn there is an indoor pool and a living room. Every wall of the barn can be lifted up and away from the structure so that the entire interior is exposed to the outdoors, to the tree peonies and lilac bushes that bloom around it in the early spring, to the panicles of wisteria that drip from its roof in the early summer. To the right of the house is a field that paints itself red with poppies in July. To the left is another, through which he and Willem scattered thousands of wildflower seeds, cosmos and daisies and foxglove and Queen Anne's lace. One weekend, shortly after they had moved in, they spent 2 days making their way through the forests before and behind the house, planting lilies of the valley near the mossy hillocks around the oak and elm trees, and sowing mint seeds throughout.
They knew Malcolm didn't approve of their landscaping efforts. He thought them sentimental and trite. And although they knew Malcolm was probably right, they also didn't really care. In spring and summer, when the air was fragrant, they often thought of Lispenard Street, its aggressive ugliness, and of how then they wouldn't even have had the visual imagination to conjure a place like this, where the beauty was so uncomplicated, so undeniable that it seemed at times an illusion. He and Harold set off toward the forest, where the rough walkway means that it is easier for him to navigate than it had been when construction began. Even so, he has to concentrate, for the path is only cleared once a season, and in the months between, it becomes cluttered with saplings and ferns and twigs and tree matter. They aren't quite halfway to the first bench when he knows he has made a mistake. His legs began throbbing as soon as they finished walking down the lawn, and now his feet are throbbing as well, and each step is agonizing. But he doesn't say anything, just grips his cane more tightly, trying to recenter the discomfort, and pushes forward, clenching his teeth and squaring his jaw. By the time they reach the bench, really a dark gray limestone boulder, he is dizzy, and they sit for a long time, talking and looking out onto the lake, which is silvery in the cold air. "It's chilly," Harold says eventually, and it is. He can feel the cool of the stone through his pants. "We should get you back to the house."
"Okay."
He swallows and stands, and immediately he feels a hot stake of pain being thrust upward through his feet and gasps, but Harold doesn't notice. They are only 30 steps into the forest when he stops Harold.
"Harold,"
he says,
I need,
but he can't finish.
"Jude,"
Harold says, and he can tell Harold is worried. He takes his left arm, slings it around his neck, and holds his hand in his own.
"Lean on me as much as you can,"
Harold says, putting his other arm around his waist, and he nods.
"Ready?"
He nods again. He's able to take 20 more steps, such slow steps, his feet tangling in the mulch, before he simply can't move anymore.
"I can't, Harold,"
he says, and by this time he can barely speak, the pain is so extreme, so unlike anything he has felt in such a long time. Not since he was in the hospital in Philadelphia have his legs, his back, his feet hurt so profoundly. And he lets go of Harold and falls to the forest floor.
"Oh God, Jude,"
Harold says, and bends over him, helping him to sit up against a tree. And he thinks how stupid, how selfish he is. Harold is 72. He should not be asking a 72-year-old man, even an admirably healthy 72-year-old man, for physical assistance. He cannot open his eyes because the world is torquing itself around him, but he hears Harold take out his phone, hears him try to call Willem, but the forest is so dense that the reception is poor, and Harold curses.
"Jude,"
he hears Harold say, but his voice is very faint.
"I'm going to have to go back to the house and get your wheelchair. I'm so sorry. I'm going to be right back."
He nods, barely, and feels Harold button his coat closed, feels him push his hands into his coat's pockets, feels him wrap something around his legs. Harold's own coat, he realizes.
"I'll be right back,"
Harold says.
"I'll be right back."
He hears Harold's feet running away from him, the crunch of the sticks and leaves as they snap and crumple beneath him. He turns his head to the side, and the ground beneath him shifts, dangerously, and he vomits, coughing up everything he has eaten that day, feels it slide off of his lips and drool down his cheek. Then he feels a bit better, and he leans his head against the tree again. He is reminded of his time in the forest when he was running away from the home, how he had hoped the trees might protect him, and now he hopes for it again. He takes his hand out of his pocket, feels for his cane, and squeezes it as hard as he can. Behind his eyelids, bright, spangled drops of light burst into confetti, and then blink out into oily smears. He concentrates on the sound of his breath and on his legs, which he imagines as large, lumpen shards of wood, into which had been drilled dozens of long metal screws, each as thick as a thumb. He pictures the screws being drawn out in reverse, each one rotating slowly out of him and landing with a ringing clang on a cement floor. He vomits again. He is so cold. He can feel himself begin to spasm. And then he hears someone running toward him, and he can smell it is Willem, his sweet sandalwood scent, before he hears his voice. Willem gathers him, and when he lifts him, everything sways again, and he thinks he is going to be sick, but he isn't, and he puts his right arm around Willem's neck and turns his vomity face into his shoulder and lets himself be carried. He can hear Willem panting. He may weigh less than Willem, but they are still the same height, and he knows how unwieldy he must be, his cane still in his hand, banging against Willem's thighs, his calves knocking against Willem's ribcage, and he is grateful when he feels himself being lowered into his chair, hears Willem's and Harold's voices above him. He bends over, resting his forehead on his knees, and is pushed back out of the forest and up the hill to the house, and once inside, he is lifted into bed. Someone takes off his shoes, and he screams out and is apologized to. Someone wipes his face. Someone wraps his hands around a hot water bottle. Someone wraps his legs with blankets. Above him, he can hear Willem being angry.
"Why did you fucking go along with this? You know he can't fucking do this!"
And Harold's apologetic, miserable replies.
"I know, Willem. I'm so sorry. It was moronic. But he wanted to go so badly."
He tries to speak, to defend Harold, to tell Willem it was his fault, that he made Harold come with him. But he can't.
"Open your mouth," Willem says, and he feels a pill, bitter as metal, being placed on his tongue. He feels a glass of water being tipped toward his lips.
"Swallow," Willem says, and he does, and soon after, the world ceases to exist. When he wakes, he turns and sees Willem in bed with him, staring at him.
"I'm so sorry," he whispers.
But Willem doesn't say anything. He reaches over and runs his hand through Willem's hair.
"Willem," he says, "it wasn't Harold's fault. I made him do it."
Willem snorts.
"Obviously," he says, "but he still shouldn't have agreed to it." They are quiet for a long time, and he thinks of what he needs to say, what he has always thought but never articulated.
"I know this is going to sound illogical to you," he tells Willem,
who looks back at him.
"But even all these years later, I still can't think of myself as disabled. I mean, I know I am. I know I am. I have been for twice as long as I haven't been. It's the only way you've known me, as someone who needs help. But I remember myself as someone who used to be able to walk whenever he wanted to, as someone who used to be able to run. I think every person who becomes disabled thinks they were robbed of something. But I suppose I've always felt that, that if I acknowledge that I am disabled, then I'll have conceded to Dr. Traylor. Then I'll have let Dr. Traylor determine the shape of my life. And so I pretend I'm not. I pretend I am who I was before I met him. And I know it's not logical or practical. But mostly I'm sorry because I know it's selfish. I know my pretending has consequences for you. So I'm going to stop."
He takes a breath, closes and opens his eyes.
"I'm disabled," he says. "I'm handicapped."
And as foolish as it is, he is 47 after all. He has had 32 years to admit this to himself. He feels himself about to cry.
"Oh, Jude," says Willem, and pulls him toward him. "I know you're sorry. I know this is hard. I understand why you've never wanted to admit it. I do. I just worry about you. I sometimes think I care more about your being alive than you do.
He shivers, hearing this.
No, Willem, he says. I mean, maybe at one